And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
That doesn't sound good.
Paper shredder's jammed, but I think I fixed it.
Oh, well, try shredding these $50 bills then.
Seems like it's working.
Better try another $400.
Stop. Instead of using money, use regular paper. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.
Hi, this is Justin Coletti of Sonic Scoop, and today we are talking all about that bass, no treble. Yes, we are talking about low end and getting your low end to sit right. This is one of the hardest parts of audio, whether you're recording or mixing or producing or mastering. It's one of the hardest parts to get right and one of the most essential parts to get right. I've got a handful of great tips for you here that I really think are going to transform the way that you approach low end. And no matter who you are, I think you're going to come away with at least one new strategy from this. And I'm saving the best one for last, so be sure to stay tuned. Quick shout out to our sponsors for this episode, SoundToys.com, making some of my favorite plugins, Eventide, making some of the most interesting hardware and software effects, and my full-length courses, Mixing Breakthroughs and Mastering Demystified. You can get them together in the Mix and Master Bundle, which is a good way to go. Enough of that for now. We'll talk about that later. Let's get right into this thing that pains so many of us. It is the reason for car checks, for headphone checks, for the, I just need to check this mix in one more place, the low end. And there is a lot of reasons that low end give us so much trouble. And one of the biggest reasons is a lot of us have deficiencies in our room. I'll talk about that in a minute. Some of us may have deficiencies in our speaker setup. I'll talk about that too. But even if you get your room and your speakers working really well together and you're getting a lot out of them, you're still gonna have trouble potentially mixing the low end because it's easy to make really bad decisions regarding the low end. Okay, so a couple quick things here. One good way to deal with low end if you're in a compromised environment is to listen on smaller speakers that actually don't put out a lot of low end. And this is counterintuitive at first, but it's one of the reasons that the Yamaha NS10s and the classic Oratone Super Sound Cubes are so popular. Neither of those speakers put out much of anything below 100 hertz or so. And they're pretty free of resonances, which is good because they have a nice closed cabinet design. So any low end that you are getting is relatively resonance free. But one of the reasons they're so popular is because they kind of take the low lows out of the equation and they force you to mix in a way and make, you know, production decisions in a way where you're not going to just be thinking about the subbiest subs when it comes to low end. Instead, you're going to be making decisions around, say, your bass instruments and your kick drum-like instruments that force you to think about how are these instruments speaking in the mid-range. Because one of the big things about getting your low end to sit right is getting the mid-range of your low-end instruments to sit right. A lot of people say, oh, I want to hear more bass guitar, or I want to hear more kick drum. So they go down and they try to boost a low bass frequency. There's a couple of problems with this. One of them is boosting frequencies down there might not do a lot of good to a lot of your audience who are listening on earbuds or listening on their phone, you know, with just the speaker, you know, not even earbuds in there, or they're listening on their laptop or they're listening on inexpensive speakers that aren't putting out frequencies of 100 hertz and below. So you really want to make sure that your low-end instruments can still be heard and still have some articulation even when people are listening on compromised systems. That's one of the big reasons that you don't want to only focus on the low end when you're mixing or recording low end instruments. You also want to think about how they're speaking in the upper registers. This is so huge because even when you are on a great big system that can put out those low lows, having the mid-range of your low frequency instruments work right is essential. If you get this right, you're going to draw attention to those low lows. And your ear really does hear and get a sense for detail in the mid-range better than in the low frequencies. So if there's a little mid-range nugget to go along with a low frequency impulse, it can draw attention to it and clarify what's going on in the low frequency. So rather than your low end sounding indistinct and kind of amorphous, once you've coupled it with a mid-range edge that sits along with it, you're bringing clarity and definition and intelligibility to the low frequencies that are there. In many cases, to make your bass guitar, your bass synth, your kick drum stand out more, it's not about boosting the low end below 100 hertz. It's actually about boosting an appropriate frequency further up. you've probably heard about this to a degree with, you know, rock kick drums already, if you've ever worked in that idiom, where adding a little bit of presence on top of that kick drum will often do so much more for getting that kick drum heard than boosting the very bottom end of that kick drum. So it's very common in a lot of genres to boost 4K, 5K, something like that on a kick drum. Could be 3K, could be 6K. There's no rule about it, but that upper mid-range nugget will often help a kick drum stick through. It depends on the aesthetic you're going for here. If you're looking for a very tight, contemporary, you know, heavy metal kick drum sound that'd be appropriate for speed metal or something, it can actually end up having a sound where you're sucking out a lot of the low mids. And it wouldn't be uncommon to suck out a ton of, say, 250 hertz and 500 hertz out of that kick drum and put a pretty significant boost at 2K, 4K, 5K, and really focus on getting the kick drum to kind of have some attack and really kind of cut through and compete with guitars and other elements. Don't take these frequencies as gospel. It could be exactly the wrong thing for the particular mix and particular sound that you're working at. But that idea of first getting that mid-range balance right and then checking out what's going on with the low end can be a good way for a lot of people to work, especially if you're in a compromised environment. Another big common trick for getting something to stick out is, this is super common for, say, bass guitar or even bass synth, and that is maybe to create a parallel track. Super common among people mixing bass. You have, say, a bass DI. You might have a parallel bass track that's really, really compressed, maybe even has some distortion, and maybe really is only focused on adding some mid-range. It's really important to create this kind of bass malt, I would call it, in context. Because here's the thing, if you're doing this technique properly on something like a bass guitar, it could and potentially even should sound terrible in solo. Like, it's probably going to sound like a fuzzy, distorted bass with this weird fizzy thing on it, and it can sound grainy and awful. But then all of a sudden, you bring everything else into context in the mix, and you don't hear all the fizz. You hear the low end with some definition. And this is, again, a huge principle when it comes to getting your low end instruments to stand out. Don't always be thinking about boosting the low end. Think about boosting some of the articulate frequencies in that instrument that's going to make your ear notice what's going on in the low end. A lot of people actually go about this completely backwards. They end up with mixes where they feel like there's not enough low end in their mix and they're just not hearing enough low end. So they add a sub to their room, or they're doing things to try to get more low end in their mixing environment. But this can be a mistake, because one of these master tips I want to give you to understand is that your mixes, to a degree, will sound like the inverse of your speakers. So if you want to have mixes with a lot of big jam and low end, you don't want to hear a lot of big jam and low end necessarily in your room. You don't want to be having an overabundance of low frequency while you're making mixing and production choices. Because if you do, the end consumer is going to hear very little low end. Because you're jazzing yourself up with so much low end, you're not doing enough to make sure that the low end really can be heard across speaker systems. You're hearing big jam and low end, so you're like, ah, the low end's good. No, if you have a lot of low end in your room, excessive low end in your room, your mixers are going to end up bass light. And also the other way around, if you can't hear your low end, you might overcompensate and overboost your lowest frequencies. And this brings us into our second big tip for today, which is, don't boost what you can't hear. I know this is a little counterintuitive. I just said a minute ago that you should think about doing some mixing on small bass light speakers, and that could help you because it's going to make you think about the mid-range of your instruments. But if you are doing that, if you're mixing on NS10s or speakers that don't have a lot of low end in them, don't make the mistake of boosting 60 hertz on everything because you feel like you should. If you're boosting in the subs and you really can't hear that boost, as a general rule, don't make it. As a mastering engineer, I will say that one of the most common things I get on tracks that come through is an overabundance of low end, particularly on kick drums, under, say, 100 hertz. Maybe there's a big hump around 60 hertz or 70 hertz or something like that. And in many cases, they'll come from a mix engineer overboosting one of those frequencies. Very common thing to deal with at the mastering stage. And this is often one of the very first things that mastering engineers look to address. When I first started mastering at Joe Lambert's studio, I sat down with Joe and got a sense for his process and really kind of watched him work and had him explain to me how he goes about it. And what he always starts with is the low end. With a very simple shelving filter, he'll go in there and say, do we have too much low end on this track, or do we have too little? Do we need to add low end, or do we need to decrease low end? And a lot of the time, the mixes will come in and there'll be just a little bit too much low end going on that's kind of muffling other things. And the mixers don't realize it, but you actually need to add some additional control at the mastering stage below 100 hertz because people are boosting frequencies that they couldn't hear. So this is master tip number two here. Don't boost frequencies that you can't hear. First one is focus on your mid-range, not just your bottom end, and then don't boost things that you can't hear. Fortunately, tip one here, rule one, gives you a lot of leeway to boost other things. Which leads us to tip number three. Tip number three should actually probably be tip number one. It is make sure the low end in your room is as good as it can be. The reason so many of us have problems mixing low end is because we're in environments where we really can't hear what's going on in the low end. And if we could, we could make much better decisions, or at least start learning how to make much better decisions. So one of the first things that you want to do here is get your speakers into a good position in your room. This is an overlooked part of setting up a studio. I actually just did a long video, kind of long masterclass workshop on just proper speaker placement, because this is huge. Even before you put acoustic treatment on the walls, just getting your speakers into a good place in the room, or even more importantly, explicitly, getting them out of bad places in the room can really help your low frequency response and really help you get rid of nulls and dips in your room. I don't have time right now to go through all of the principles of proper speaker placement with you, but I will link to that video. Maybe it'll show up somewhere right here, right now, and also in the description. Definitely something you want to check out. One thing you definitely want to avoid is loading your speakers into corners. You're going to have a lot of low frequency problems that way. But another thing that can be bad, but isn't the end of the world, is if your speakers are too close to the wall. If you have your speakers too close to the wall, you will get a kind of shelf EQ. So if you have speakers really close to the wall, you get a low frequency boost out of your speakers. This is a bit of a problem because, again, if you're hearing too much low frequency in the room, you're going to end up with bass light mixes and you're going to drive yourself crazy and you're going to have a lot of problems. However, this is a relatively easy problem to fix with EQ, and that's why so many speakers have a little shelving EQ on the back of them. It's to deal with the fact that, hey, if you're in a small room, speakers end up too close to the wall, you've got a little too much low frequency buildup, hey, use that shelf EQ. So the shelf EQ is on your speakers for a reason. Almost any pair of speakers has some kind of shelf, and it is for that reason. If you have bass light mixes, too much low end in the room, because your speakers are super close to the wall, say, you know, under a couple of feet from the wall, that's something to look at. If your speakers are further out, you might have room modes and nodes, dips in particular frequencies. But a big thing to do is to get them into a good place where you have a minimum of these dips and nulls in the room, and then add some acoustic treatment. This is some of the best money you're ever going to spend in the studio. If you don't have the money to spend, there are great DIY plans out there for acoustic treatment. You're going to need, if you're doing broadband absorbers like I have on most of these walls, you're going to want the really thick stuff, like 6 inches thick in your corners. It can actually start to help you with some of the low frequencies. So getting your low end under control with both good speaker placement, good choice in speakers, and a little bit of acoustic treatment to help you out, that's going to be huge in helping you make decisions. But like I said at the outset, even if you have a great acoustic environment to work in and great set of speakers to work on, there are problems that you're still going to need to work to solve. Just because you hear the problem doesn't mean you know how to fix it yet. So I'll give you two last things, and I'm saving the best one for last, so stay with me. One of them is one of the biggest problems that people have with low end, particularly when you're dealing with live musicians, not just electronic music, is consistency in the low end. And this is huge. Particularly if you're working with a lot of beginner or intermediate drummers, they might be a little bit inconsistent with their kick foot. They might get a little happy on the kick drum on the first beat of every measure. And it might be too much kick on, say, the very first beat in each bar. Or maybe when they start a new section, like, oh, the chorus is here, extra loud kick hit. And you'll start to notice some of these dynamic inconsistencies with drummers who haven't been in the studio a lot. They don't really have a lot of control over the dynamics yet, particularly in their cymbals and the kick drum. That seems to be the hardest part for a lot of newer drummers or even intermediate drummers to get right. So what do you do about that? There's a couple ways to go. One, you know, compression and parallel compression can help you in particular. This can be extremely useful. I talk about parallel compression a lot. It's a really fun and easy way to get more consistency out of a drum kit without getting all the artifacts that you might get from applying a lot of compression to the main stereo drum mix. If you put compression across the whole drum kit, things can get a little bit funky because when that super heavy kick drum hit comes in, it's pulling down the cymbals more on that hit. So it's changing the tonality on that hit instead of changing the dynamics once you're compressing it. Parallel compression can help you get around that a little bit. Another thing to do that's very popular these days is sample replacement. But rather than just go sample replacing everything and finding a new, even better kick sample, there are two things I want you to think about here. One is think about layering, finding samples that blend with the organic sound of the kit if you're working in a rock or pop genre that uses an acoustic kit. And even better yet, not just layer, but you could potentially layer things with your own samples. This can be a super useful thing to do, especially if you're in a recording session with a drummer where you get a sense that their kick is a little bit uneven. You can take samples of that drummer right there in that studio, get a few quarter note and half note and eighth note kicks just recorded separately by themselves at the end of the session. Now you have your own samples that you can fold back in under their kit. And the beautiful thing here is if you got a tone that you really like, you're not necessarily changing the tone. You're just giving a little consistent level of support to the entire track. So you'll get more consistency that way. A little bit more of an advanced tip here is you would duck that support on those heaviest, most overemphasized kick hits. So let's pretend you have a drummer. Again, he's just hitting things too heavy foot on the downbeat or on the first beat of every section. Well, when that hit comes along, you just put in less of that supporting sample. And in all the other hits, you put in some more of that supporting sample. And that is a great way to get some of the support and beef and consistency of a sample without radically altering the tone and without getting some of the sacrifices that you would get from pretty heavy compression. And you can even automate this with a sidechain compressor. Here's an idea for you. Instead of having to automate it manually or with copy and paste, you can have a compressor on your supporting samples and have that be triggered by your main kick drum. So whenever your main kick drum gets too loud, instead of compressing that main kick drum, it'll just turn down the supporting sample. And this will help you get really, really consistent kick drum hits without too much of the artifacting that you'd hear by trying to directly compress your main kick drum track. A really sneaky and, dare I say, ingenious solution to this problem. Okay, and our last big tip here is, this is like the master tip to low end. This is one of the biggest things I've ever encountered. It's one of those things that every single mixer who mixes really well figures out and does right. At some point in their career, they figure this out. And that is that only one element can be the lowest one in your mix, right? This should be obvious. You can't have two elements be the lowest. Only one can be the lowest, and your other elements have to be above it. It sounds like a no-brainer when I say it out loud, but so few people actually apply this properly to their mixes. When you get to mixing, or even arranging and recording, I want you to think really clearly about this. Say to yourself consciously, even write it down, which element in this production should be the lowest one? Is it the kick? Is it that synth bass? Is it that bass guitar? Because you can't have two of them be the lowest. I'll tell you, I really discovered this in a significant way and really felt it in my bones probably too late into my career. By a time where I should have known better and I should have been applying this already, it still hit me in the head when I already knew I should be doing this. I was at a Strange Weather recording studio not too many years ago, owned by a good friend of mine, Mark Allen Goodman. Beautiful place. It's got one of those control rooms where the lows go so deep, you can hear everything. It's like being in a mastering studio, really precise monitoring, great acoustic treatment, and I still was getting terrible low end on this mix. It just felt murky, indistinct. There just wasn't any definition in my bass or my kick. There wasn't a good pulse to things. It was just kind of this slow, throbbing mess down there. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. I was trying different boosts and different cuts. And Mark said to me, "Justin, why don't you try on that bass synth there, cutting out some low frequencies, just putting a low cut on there." And I said, "Put a low cut on bass synth? How can I put a low cut on a bass synth? It's a bass instrument. It's supposed to have bass." He said, "Just give it a try. Give it a try. You know, maybe you're right, but try it out." So there was this kick drum, bass guitar, and a bass synth. And I said, "Well, how much low end do you want me to cut out of this bass synth?" He said, "Give it a try. Everything below 100 hertz or below 120. Just give it a shot." I said, "I don't know." So I give it a try, and all of a sudden, the low end sounded awesome. Because all of a sudden, there wasn't this giant, pulsing, sustaining pad in the extreme low end covering up what was happening with the kick and the bass guitar. By taking bass out of a bass instrument, I made the low end sound better. Wow. So in this mix, there were three different elements: a kick, a bass, and a bass synth. And only one of them can be the lowest. And the other two have to sit on top of that lowest element. And instead of the bass synth needing to support things by adding extra sub, it just supported kind of the outline of the bass line with a little bit more mid-range and upper bass added to it. But all of a sudden, I had all this room down there where the kick and bass spoke beautifully together. And all of a sudden, you were grooving, you were bobbing your head, the low end came into focus. In most situations where you're going to run into this issue, say you're just going to have one kick and one bass to make it simple, you have to figure out, should the kick drum be the lowest and the bass sits on top of it, or should the bass be the lowest and the kick drum live on top of it? This is one of those key kind of eureka things that when you figure it out, you really get through your head and you really start applying it to every mix you start working on, everything starts getting better. It is, in fact, one of the five key habits that I think every great mixer does. And what you might find, surprisingly, in many cases, is that in some of your low-frequency instruments, you can actually get rid of some low-frequency content, whether that's with a shelf, maybe taking some low-frequency out of a bass, or whether that's a low cut, taking some lows out of a bass or a kick drum. But just remember, this is one of those master tips where really every great mixer does it at some point. And that is, figure out what should be the lowest element in your mix. Should it be your kick drum, or should it be your bass guitar? Should your kick drum be on the bottom with the bass guitar sitting above it, or vice versa? And if there's multiple low frequency instruments, you got even more decisions to make. But you want to stop things from fighting with each other down there. And you want to have each region of your bass frequencies be owned by a specific low frequency instrument that has dominance in that area. How do you decide which one should be the lowest, the kick drum or the bass? Well, I can go into more details on that. And I do. I just put out a new free workshop that you can check out. It is a half hour with me where we talk about five of the biggest, most important habits that every single really great mixer applies to really every single mix. And this is called for me studying the work of so many great mixers and producers and engineers and finding the commonalities. And this is one of them. Check out that free workshop. I will put a link to it in the show notes and in the description, or you can check it out at sonicscoop.com/mixhabits. That's sonicscoop.com/mixhabits. And you will get five of the habits that every one of the greats is putting into their work. Five habits that you can adopt right now to really change for the better and permanently your entire approach to mixing and record production. And this is tip number two in there, where I go into some more detail on picking which one should be the lowest frequency element in your mix. Well, wow, we have covered a lot of ground. I hope this has been useful for you. I hope you're coming away with some good stuff from this. How could you not? I think this was a pretty good episode. Let me know. Did you make it this far? Tell me in the comments below if you're on YouTube, if you got this far. Shoot me an email at podcast@sonicscoop.com. I read every single one. Remember to like and subscribe. And if you're on YouTube, hit that notifications bell so you're alerted whenever a new one of these episodes come out. If you're listening to the audio version of the podcast on iTunes or the like, if you have a moment to leave a positive review, hopefully a 5-star review, just an honest review, that will be fine. That's all that I ask for. If you can leave me an honest review on iTunes or any of the other podcast services, it really helps this podcast get heard by more people so that we can have more good audio in the world. So please help me out in that. Thanks again for joining me. If you want even more depth with me on 5 of the most important habits to start putting into your mixes right away, check it out. Free workshop at sonicscoop.com/mixhabits. That's sonicscoop.com/mixhabits. I'll try to put a link here somewhere on the screen or down in the show notes on all versions of this episode of the podcast. This has been Justin Coletti of Sonic Scoop. Big shout out to all of our sponsors this week. Soundtoys, making some of my favorite plugins in the known universe. Check them out, soundtoys.com, where you can try out anything they make for free. If you haven't tried out the Soundtoys 5 bundle yet, just do it right now. Just type in soundtoys.com and then go and then get it for free and try it out for, I think, 15 days or something like that. And whether you decide to buy it or not, you'll know what all the hype is about. And you'll know that I'm not crazy for bringing them up on the podcast every week. Also, Eventide, making some of my favorite, most interesting hardware and software effects. Check them out, eventideaudio.com. You can also try out anything and everything they make for free. Highly recommended, some of the weirdest and most interesting plugins and hardware effects out there. Great stuff from both of those guys. Also brought to you by my 2 full-length courses, Mixing Breakthroughs and Mastering Demystified. By far, probably the most useful thing I've ever done for people in audio and music production. Check them out. Great way to get them is with the Mix and Master bundle, where you can get a discount for getting them both together, which I definitely recommend. Thanks for hanging out with me. Hope to see you at that free workshop. That is sonicscoop.com/mixhabits. Thanks for hanging out with me. This has been Justin Coletti of Sonic Scoop. See you next time.